Hello and welcome to this week's episode of Goals on Film, Edge of the Crowd's dedicated sports movies podcast. I'm your host, Jason, and I've got Stewie with me today. How are you doing?
Good, thanks, mate. Excited to talk about this flick. I've got mixed feelings about it. I know you do too. So let's get on with it, mate.
Yeah, we've put last week aside, have we? We're not revisiting that at all. And I think, this week's selection is a bit better than that one. Not a bit better, a lot better. And so we will get into it now. All right, this week we are celebrating the start of the MLB postseason, which at the time of release, it will have begun. So Friday in Australia. And we are also celebrating the Durham Bulls, the AAA national champions, back-to-back national championships, they won 10-6 in Vegas in that respective match. And so we are looking at 1988 romantic comedy baseball film, Bull Durham. Just to give you a little bit of a synopsis about this movie, it follows veteran minor league catcher Crash Davis, who is assigned to Class A Durham Bulls in an effort to help the team's star rookie, a wild pitcher by the name of Ebby Kelvin Nuke Lelouch, mature as he enters his first season in the minor leagues and at the professional level. As the 1987 season begins, team groupie Annie romances both players, with her and Nuke eventually getting into a relationship. Nuke also receives guidance from Crash, who settles Nuke's erratic pitching and teaches him to follow the catcher's lead. Once Nuke starts to listen to Crash, his own game and that of the Bulls improves so much that Nuke gets called up to the show. That's pretty much the whole sort of plot in a roundabout way. Stewie, what were your thoughts on the film?
Well, I said to you last week that I was excited to do this movie because I remembered it when I was a kid and I really enjoyed it. And it really was a part of like a bit of a golden age of baseball movies. There's a lot of great baseball movies that came out in the late 80s, early 90s. And Bull Durham is one that is considered to have ushered in this success. With the success of Bull Durham, we got Field of Dreams, Major League, The Rookie, Eight Men Out as well. A stack of movies anyway. So I was excited to I was excited to jump into it, easy for me to say. I gotta say I didn't dislike the movie, but it wasn't as good as I remember. For context sake and for people that are keeping score on this kind of thing, it got a 6 out of 10 from me on IMDb.
Yeah, I think that this is one of those films that, you know, you do watch when you are young and, you know, you are sort of like invested in it and the hype of it. And, you know, it was in a golden age of baseball movies as well. And so I think that you do group those together and you just like think about how many baseball movies came out at the time. And, you know, you might go on a little bit of a run of like watching them all in like sort of succession. And so like, I think that that helps like, you know, the allure of like, of this movie especially, but in terms of like these baseball movies in general as well. But I think that upon watching this, you know, like you, Stewie, I think that, you know, that nostalgia, you know, it was probably just that. I think that, you know, it's very different, or it was for me at least, like very different watching it back, you know, I don't know, probably like 10 years ago for me, to be honest, compared to now. And I just think that like so much of what I remember it like seemed lost on this viewing this week, in the lead up to this movie. I think that, yeah, I think that there was so much of like particular parts of the movie. I think like a bit of like the pacing of the movie. I think like some of the scenes in the movie, it sort of like took away from, for me, like it took away from the main storyline of Chase coming out to help Nuke and improve his game. And I think that, yeah, like that storyline, like I think that, you know, the other storylines that sort of like strayed too far away from like what that main storyline was, like for me, I think.
Yeah, no, I totally agree with that analysis, mate. I think you hit the nail on the head. I think also, and this is something that we've encountered a few times when we've done older movies here on Goals on Film, shout out the club. Just like there's some issues with some of the themes in the movies that are a little bit, you know, hard to stomach in 2022. We're probably totally acceptable in the late 1980s. But you know, I had a tough time with some of the themes, particularly how women are portrayed in the movie. It's not a good look for the creators of the movie and stuff. So it's definitely, it's dated by that, I think. And I think just going forwards, it's going to be something that, you know, when we do older movies and stuff, it's something that we're going to encounter more and more often.
Yeah, I think like it's a good sort of like reminder about, you know, the differences between like what's acceptable or what was back then, what might be now, and like, you know, probably like give a bit of an assessment on whether it would be acceptable today. And I think that, yeah, to your point about like how sort of like women were viewed or treated in this movie, it probably wouldn't fly today. I think that just like all the sort of like you know, allusions to like, you know, sex with players, and then like, you know, only getting like that sort of like access because, you know, your father paid for a scoreboard or something like that. I think that just like, you know, having a groupie who, you know, picks a player each year and is like, you know, you're the person that I'm going to have sex with all year, you're going to get better by it. But, you know, just like in terms of like that sort of stuff, yeah, I think that we can probably look back on and say that, you know, that's just not cool. Like, we wouldn't really see that in a movie today.
Well, I'm actually appreciate the time that we're living in now, because let's not mince words. Susan Sarandon, fantastic actress, Oscar-winning actress. Mm-hmm. You know, essentially her only parts in the movie were, you know, the kind of that groupie role. I mean, she had a couple of scenes. I think there was one in the batting cages towards the beginning of the movie. But yeah. Otherwise, she was just in there as kind of a I don't know the correct term to use.
The word that I've seen used is like femme fatale.
Yep. That tracks. Yeah, and just you know, the other women in there are basically just, you know, there's the woman that gets married.
Mm-hmm.
Is that the same as the daughter from the start of the movie?
I think so. Yeah.
Oh,
really?
Well, that was fucking lost on me, mate, let me tell you. Hey, and that me dropping the F-bomb there, that makes me think something that really struck me as well is there is a lot of cursing in this movie, like a lot of cursing.
Yeah.
Both of the, you and I just both confessed to watching this when probably we were far too young to be watching it.
Yeah.
And that's something that I was thinking while I was watching it. What was mum doing? Let me watch this movie when I was a young fella. It warped my tiny little mind. So, yeah. A lot of cursing, problematic portrayal of women. Yeah. That's they. Unfortunately, you know, given that the great Kevin Costner plays the lead role in this movie, and the sometimes great Tim Robbins is in it as well. Oscar winner Susan Sarandon is in it also, another tremendous actor. They were my takeaways, the coarse language and yeah, problematic portrayal of women.
Yeah, fair enough. All right, we'll move on now to looking at references to history. And so we'll start off by this one in terms of like the main character's name. And so the main character's name is Crash Davis, and there was really a ball player named Crash Davis. And so Ron Shelton, who was involved in the making of this movie, he found Crash Davis's name in a baseball listing. His real name was Lawrence Columbus Davis, and he spent 3 years from 1940 to 1942 in the majors as an infielder for the Philadelphia Athletics before being drafted during World War II. After serving 4 years in the Navy, he enrolled at Duke University and ironically played ball for the real Durham Bulls and other teams until 1952. Realizing that he would have to get the permission of the real Crash Davis to use his name and avoid a lawsuit, essentially, Shelton approached Davis, who asked, "Do I," meaning Kevin Costner, "get the girl in the end?" And Shelton told him that he does, and Davis signed off with the permission.
Oh my God. Just touching on the history side of things, Ron Shelton.
Yeah.
This movie is, I wouldn't say biographical, but he did play baseball, in his 20s, and, a lot of, you know, which is probably a rough look for baseballers back then, because a lot of what he got from the movie with, you know, the way they talk, when they travel, how they treated women, was all taken from his experiences playing baseball. Yeah.
Yeah, no, yeah. It's interesting to like look back on that and like, you know, see that Ron Shelton, who was involved in baseball at the time, like as part of this, and like, you know, he would be able to tell, like, you know, exactly how it happened at the time and how, you know, the sort of, you know, baseball was at the time. And yeah, he would have given a factual account. So like, if this was the factual account, then it's pretty, you know, sad to look back on that was how it was.
Absolutely, yeah.
So when Crash Davis first arrives to the Durham Bulls, he mentions Larry Hockett pitching for El Paso when Crash was batting for Shreveport in the Texas League 5 years prior. In 1983, there were Texas League teams in the mentioned cities, the El Paso Diablos and the Shreveport Captains. Both teams still exist in the Texas League now under new names. The Diablos became the Springfield Cardinals and the Captains became the Frisco Rough Riders.
See, it's interesting. This is an issue that I have with American sports more broadly, and we're already getting off track, right? You say that these teams still exist. Do they? They don't have the same nickname. They're not even in the same towns anymore. Like the piece of paper that says that they're a team, the piece of paper that says you have a license to play in this league still exists.
Yeah.
But they're not in the same places, right? They don't even have the same nicknames. They probably don't even wear the same colors anymore. So anyway, no, get us back on track.
No, I mean, I was going to continue your point, okay, to be honest.
Yeah, yeah. Go on. I'm glad. Jump on board, mate.
I think it is interesting because, like, you do see so many teams, like, you know, change names or, you know, even go, like, that couple of steps further to changing locations as well. And so, like, you know, coming under another team name in that case as well. And yeah, I think that it is interesting because like there's obviously like so much history tied to each of these teams still, but they are operating under another banner now. And so it's like, you know, that's still technically the same team, but it's, you know, under a different name. And so like, do you include like the history of, you know, both, I guess, names under the one sort of roof? Or do you separate them?
I guess the history is what you buy when you buy the license, right? You buy the history. But my question for you is, you're a Richmond Tigers fan, right?
Yeah.
Say they change their name to the Alice Springs Emus and they played in Alice Springs. Would you still go for that team? Would that still be your team?
I mean, part of me says probably, but part of me would also say, oh, well, it's not as easy for me to get to games there. So I'm going to have like a backup team that's still in Melbourne and, you know, possibly go for them now.
Yeah. See, I'm Adelaide Crows fan, right? If the Adelaide Crows suddenly relocated to Kalgoorlie and renamed themselves the Koalas or something, that would be it for me. I'd probably just stop watching footy, to be honest.
Yeah.
Anyway.
No, that's interesting. It's interesting to think about because I know that, yeah, I've got a couple of like Western Bulldogs supporting friends that, you know, are like that as well. You know, if they weren't part of the league anymore or if they like, you know, went somewhere else, became someone else, merged with someone else, like they wouldn't support them. So I think it is an interesting conversation.
It is an interesting conversation. Way off track. We're way, way off track. Get us back on the map, Jason.
All right, no worries, I will. And so when Nuke is promoted to the majors, we see him giving a television interview full of cliches that he has learned from Crash.
Teach me something new, man. I need to learn. Teach me something.
Well, you got something to write with? Good, it's time to work on your interviews.
My interviews? What do I got to do?
You're going to have to learn your cliches. You're going to have to study them. You're going to have to know them. They're your friends. Write this down. We got to play him one day at a time.
Got to play. It's pretty boring.
Of course it's boring. That's the point. Write it down.
One day at a time.
All right. I'm just happy to be here. Hope I can help the ball club. I know. Write it down. I just want to give it my best shot. And the good Lord willing, things will work out.
could, Lord willing, things will work out. Yep.
And this scene was filmed at Arlington Stadium, which was the former home field of the Texas Rangers. At the end of the movie, he gives this interview. And at the time, the Durham Bulls were the single A affiliate of the Atlanta Braves. They're now the triple A affiliate of the Tampa Bay Rays. But obviously at this time, single A affiliate of the Atlanta Braves, who are a National League team. The only way Nuke would have been at the Texas Rangers Stadium would have been if he had been traded to an American League team or if the Braves were playing the Rangers in the World Series and only being an end-of-season roster expansion rookie. And so Nuke likely wouldn't have been on the Braves postseason roster. Interleague play only started in the MLB in 1997, 9 years after the movie's release. And at the time, teams from the National League played in American League ballparks and vice versa. The only time that that happened was during the World Series. And so neither the Rangers or the Braves made it to the 1988 postseason. So rendering all of this, you know, not factual.
That's interesting. There's a lot to unpack there. And I have a lot of questions in order to help you unpack them. Fascinating to me that interleague play didn't occur until 1997. So the American League and the National League remain completely separate right up to the World Series. Is that what you're telling me?
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah, right.
Up until
the World Series.
World Series, yeah.
Yeah, right. Okay, that's interesting. The second thing I wanted to say was, we've talked about how dated this movie is with some of its themes and stuff. All those cliches that Nuke was sprouting at the end.
I'm just happy to be here, and I hope I can help the ball club. You know, I just want to give it my best shot, and good Lord willing, things will work out. You know, you got to play them one day at a time, though. Ran, right? That's a beautiful name. Is that Greek? Is that Ran? I don't know. It's a beautiful name, though. There's a great song by Motley Crue. Do you know the Ray-Ann, she's a stay-in? You know? Anyway, a good friend of mine used to say, this is a very simple game. You throw the ball, you catch the ball, you hit the ball. Sometimes you win, sometimes you lose, sometimes it rains. Think about that for a
while. You can still catch all those cliches the end of any sporting event in 2022. So that's interesting. That's one thing that hasn't dated too poorly. And the third thing I wanted to say, once again, I'm trying to get us way off track, but you said it was Arlington Stadium?
Arlington Stadium.
Interesting fact. Tim Robbins, my favorite Tim Robbins movie is a movie called Arlington Road, about domestic terrorism. It's a fantastic movie, and I recommend everybody watch it once you finish listening to the pod.
Of course, yes.
Of course.
Most important thing to finish at this time. During a conversation between Crash and Nuke on the team bus, a newspaper's sports page is shown briefly with the headline reading, Hard Hitting Witten. At the time the movie was filmed in 1987, Mark Witten was a top prospect for the Toronto Blue Jays in the South Atlantic League, and that made that league's all-star game. Witten said he missed his brief moment of fame when he first saw the movie in the theater, but caught it when he rented it later, and he went on to have a fairly ordinary 11-year career in the majors, highlighted by one 1993 game in particular, in which he tied two major league records with four homers and 12 RBIs. I don't think that that's fairly ordinary, but, you know.
11 years playing professional sports, a sport that I imagine that Mark Witten loves. That's a pretty decent stint, mate.
Just a couple of others. Crash Davis, he hits his 247th home run to set a minor league record.
Come on, mate. Throw me that weak-ass shit. Come on. You're getting that cheese by me. Bring it. Bring it. Bring it.
When Crash hit his 247th home run, I knew the moment it happened, but I'm sure nobody else did. And the sporting news didn't say anything about it.
In 2015, Mike Hessman of the Toledo Mudhens hit his 437th minor league home run to set a new record. At the time of the movie, so 1988, the minor league record was 433, set by Buzz Artlett in 1937. So, but, you know, I think that, you know, Crash would have been closer to the International League record of 257, which was set by Hessman.
Yeah, right. Interesting. So that's over a career, right?
Yeah, minor league career, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. Okay, 433. I'll take, if I was wearing a hat, I'd take it off to that fella, mate. That's incredible. Just purely for selfish reasons, I'm glad we're talking about home run records. Aaron Judge, did he break the record?
He did
break the record.
He did,
he hit his 60-second home run?
Yeah.
Oh, fantastic. That's great. And he's being tested regularly, I imagine?
I would think so.
Yeah, right. Okay. No, that's tremendous. I know last week Paul forced me to watch him hitting the 61st home run. So I was interested to see if he hit the 62nd, that's all.
Yeah, no, definitely. Yeah, we've had a few home run records be hit in the last sort of week or so in the MLB, so it's been good to see.
Yeah, did someone get their 700th career home run? Yeah, Albert Pujols, right?
Yeah, that's right.
Hilarious name, serious baseball player.
Yeah, I think he's on like 703 at time of recording now, so he's very much surpassed that 700 when a lot of people didn't think that he would make 700 going into the sort of end of the season.
Yeah, right. Okay, nice one.
The rainout scene where Crash or, you know, turns on the taps essentially to start the sprinklers on the field to get a rain out and win a bet that he makes with a couple of other players. That was actually based on a real event. And so in the late 1960s, coming back to Ron Shelton, obviously played minor league baseball. Shelton's team was in Amarillo, Texas for a season ending series. The night before the final game, Shelton, some teammates and some Amarillo players were out partying and decided to go to the stadium and turn on the sprinkler system, thereby flooding the field and ensuring a rainout. However, the Amarillo team owner rented a helicopter, dried the field, and the game was played.
Oh, shit.
We'll now move on to looking at the field where the Durham Bulls played in the movie. And so it is at the old Durham Athletic Park. The Durham Bulls have since moved from that particular ballpark now as well. And it was actually the result of the movie, which was why they moved. And just like sort of the popularity of the movie. And so team owner Miles Wolf had been pushing for a new ballpark in 1988 in order to attract Triple A baseball, but the stadium plans were pushed back for years. When the film Bull Durham was released in mid-1988, it led to a major resurgence of local popular interest in the team and their ballpark. And so both the real Bulls and their movie counterparts played in the High A Carolina League in the late 1980s. And in 1990, such was the popularity of this movie as well, the Bulls became the first Class A team in history to pass the 300,000 mark in attendance for a season.
Wow. Talk about getting your cash from the turnstiles. That's impressive. And it's not even the big leagues.
I said before that the movie was filmed at Durham Athletic Park, which was the team's stadium at the time and where they played up until 1994. And so they currently play at Durham Bulls Athletic Park, which I think is just a little bit down the road. And so it's a new location, but they moved to a new location because of all the crowds that they were getting. And so I think that that's obviously a testament to this movie, especially when it obviously came out, that they felt the need that they needed to upgrade their facilities, upgrade their ballpark, and move somewhere else and just sort of couldn't cope with the demand of who wanted to be in the stands and witness a Durham Bulls game.
That's tremendous. It really is. This movie was insanely popular when it came out. Did it win awards? Was it nominated for awards? If it didn't win anything, I'm sure it was nominated. It was critically acclaimed when it came out. So, yeah.
Yeah. At the Academy Awards, Ron Shelton was nominated for Best Original Screenplay. At the Golden Globes, Susan Sarandon was nominated for Best Actress in the Musical or Comedy section. And yeah, that was all. That was all really. They won a couple. They won Best Film at the Boston Society of Film Critics. Ron Shelton won a couple for his screenplay at the Writers Guild of America Award and the Boston Society of Film Critics again, and the Los Angeles Film Critics Association. So yeah, he won quite a few. Wasn't obviously an Academy Award, but Ron Shelton definitely won a few awards for his particular screenplay, but the film overall didn't win any.
Yeah. It was still insanely popular. I'm not sure what the box office did, but it's nice to hear that the team benefited from it with a new stadium.
And so one of the main attractions of this stadium that we did see in the movie, and I think that most people associate with the Durham Bulls, is they think of the bull, as in the mechanical snorting bull that we saw when a player hit a home run and it bounced off this particular bull beyond the fence in right field.
Why is he calling for a curveball? I want to bring heat. Shake him off. Throw it you want.
God damn it. Time out. Hey! Why are you shaking me off? Huh?
I want to bring the heater to announce my presence with authority.
To announce your what?
Announce my presence with authority.
To announce your fucking presence with authority? This guy's a first ball fastball hitter. He's looking for heat.
Oh, yeah? So what? He ain't seen my heat.
All right, me. Give him your heat.
Why is he always calling me me? I'm the guy driving a Porsche.
Fastball.
Come on, Duke. Slow down. Slow down, boy. Slow down. Take your time.
Home run for Bert Brooks of the Fayetteville Generals.
What are you doing? Huh? What are you doing standing here? I give you a gift. You stand here, show off my pitcher. Run, dummy!
Give me a ball.
Well, he really hit the shit out of that one, didn't he?
Nailed it like an egg.
Yeah, and he scrambled the son of a bitch. Look at that. He hit the fucking ball. Guy gets a free steak. You having fun yet?
Oh, yeah. I'm having a blast. Thanks.
Good.
God, the sucker teed off in that like he knew I was going to throw a fastball.
He did know.
How?
I told him.
And so this particular mechanical snorting bull was brought to life as a result of Bull Durham. And so the original bull was actually a movie prop created for Hollywood, created by Kevin Costner and co. And they left it behind for use at Athletic Park. So where the Durham Bulls played at the time, and where they obviously filmed this movie as well. And so, yeah, it's cool that, you know, they made this prop for the movie and it's become a mainstay of the park. And even when the Bulls moved to Durham Bulls Athletic Park and when it opened in 1995, the prop was put out to pasture and sort of it had a stay at the ballpark as well. And so, you know, it's good to see that, like, this mechanical bull that was made for a movie, the purpose of a movie, has stayed with the team and is still a mainstay and it's still being able to see and have home runs hit towards it at the ballpark now.
Yeah, that's incredible. That's really cool. And that, so, sorry, they took it to the new stadium?
Yeah, so the new stadium. So it did, you know, get erected from the old ballpark and get put into the new stadium. It wasn't in the outfield like it is now, but it was at the new park's first base concourse, and it was sort of hung there and sort of like on show. And then it was moved from the concourse and it had its rightful place in the outfield once more. But instead of it being in right field like it was at the old ballpark, it now sits in left field.
Well, okay. Fascinating. Yeah, that's really cool. That's really cool.
Yeah. And so the snorting bull's primary function, and we did see this in the movie as well, it has remained the same. And so when a home team player homers, the bull goes into action. As the Bulls hitter circles the bases, three things happen simultaneously. Puffs of smoke spew from the Bull's nostrils, hence the snorting bull moniker. The Bull's eyes light red, thanks to embedded LED lights, and the tail wags, which accounts for the Bull's mechanized ability.
Well, that's just cool, man. There needs to be more of that kind of stuff in professional sports. I'm into that. That's awesome.
Yeah, I think it's all about like the sort of like appeal to like aim there as well. Like, so there's two parts of the bull as well in terms of there's the bull itself and there's a plaque underneath it that says hit bull win stake. And then the bull's sitting on a bed of grass and it says hit grass win salad. So you're going to try to aim for the bull to get that stake, I reckon.
Absolutely.
Because like, yeah, there is truth to that. Any batter that hits the bull sized bullseye does indeed win a stake from a local restaurant.
Oh, fantastic. I need to get out there. I need more steak in my life.
I think it's just like, yeah, a bit of like ballpark humor. You know, there's a bit of like creativity about it. I think that it just all, for me, like it just comes back to like this prop being used for the movie, but it obviously has its use in real life too. And, you know, I think that that sort of like contributes to the appeal of the ballpark and the appeal of the Durham Bulls itself.
Absolutely. It's just fun, Jason. It's yeah. fun. It's nice to know that we can have fun in professional sports still.
Just like leading on from this particular part of, you know, this segment, in the movie, the Bulls did have a mascot of a bull. And in real life, the Bulls had actually used the suit a few times before the film came out. And we're planning to do more after the film was released, but only if the suit fits someone 6'7" or taller, which made it a tough job to fill. And so it's cool that they sort of like incorporated that into the movie as well.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. 6'7". Geez, sign me up. I'm kidding.
You know, in one scene as well, like Tim Robbins' character, so Nuke, he sings a song incorrectly using the word woolly. 4 years after the movie's release, the Durham Bulls named a new mascot. And since the Depression, the mascot had been a bull. But in 1992, they created the character Woolly Bull, which sounds like woolly, but has an E for education.
You need that E. You need the education.
Yeah, you need the education to know that the song actually uses the word woolly and not... whatever else Nuke thought it was.
That's great.
Just a few like comedic sort of goofs in the movie. And I want to reference our episode of We Are Marshall, where I told you and Dan some interesting bits of information in terms of the geographical location of stuff like in that movie of like the plane site, where the characters were walking to or driving to or from. I found out a couple more in relation to this movie.
So what you're telling me is we're heading to geography school with Jason. Is that what you're telling me?
We are, yeah.
Okay, it's my favorite class. Lay it on me, brother.
So in the opening scene, Annie walks out of her house at roughly 911 North Magnum Street and turns north. She then approaches the ballpark, walking north again on Morris Street. The Durham Athletic Park is located at 428 Morris Street, approximately 1 mile south of her home on Magnum Street. Her original direction of travel would have taken her in the opposite direction to the ballpark.
What a goof. What a mistake by the producers of this movie.
The other one relates back to like where Annie lives as well. And so near the end of the film, when Annie is returning home from the ballpark in the rain with umbrella in hand, and she sees Crash on her porch swing, Annie approaches her house from the north, the wrong direction. The old Durham Athletic Ballpark where the film was shot, as we know, is west of the house. So,
well, you know, honestly, they need to get all the actors back and reshoot those shots with the correct angles, please. This is math school. This isn't geography school.
A little bit.
You're talking about angles and stuff. So, you know, I guess it's geography as well.
Yeah.
But who am I to talk? I'm not the teacher here. I'm just the student.
A plus for you.
Thanks, mate.
I just have a couple of little fun facts for you to round out this segment. So in the meeting at the pitcher's mound, Robert Wall ad-libbed his line about getting candlesticks as a wedding present. He said it was based on a real conversation that he had with his wife.
What the hell's going on out there?
Looks like a convention. Pretty soon they're going to call the roll.
Get your ass out there and check it out.
Excuse me, what the hell's going on out here?
Well, Nuke's scared because his eyelids are jammed and his old man's here. We need a live, was it a live rooster? We need a live rooster to take the curse off Jose's glove, and nobody seems to know what to get Millie or Jimmy for their wedding present. Is that about right?
That's right.
We're dealing with a lot of shit.
Okay, well, candlesticks always make a nice gift, and maybe you can find out where she's registered, maybe a place setting or maybe a silverware pattern. Okay, let's get to it. Here we go.
I did actually know that one. I was going to lay that one on you, but you beat me to the punch, Jace.
Well, before I start on my next ones, do you have any that you want to lay on me?
Nah, that was the only one I had.
All right, well, I'll continue then.
Yes, please, go ahead.
When Nuke says, "Annie, I know you're in there. I can hear that crazy Mexican music." The song, on the phonograph is "Non Je Regret Rien." It is a famous recording by Edith Piaf, who is singing in French.
Yes, she's in French. A song made famous by the movie Inception. Leonardo DiCaprio movie Inception. Yes. Mm-hmm. Great track.
In her opening monologue, Annie says there are 108 beads in a Catholic rosary and there are 108 stitches in a baseball. It is true that there is 108 stitches in a baseball. And while a set of Hindu or Buddhist prayer beads has 108 beads, the most commonly used Catholic rosary only has 59.
Once again, get the movie back, reshoot it. These are embarrassing for the makers of this film.
All right, we will move on now and we will look at how true to the sport that Bull Durham portrays baseball. And so I think that, you know, if we want to talk about like in terms of like the baseball play itself, and I think like we've already sort of like established a little bit, you know, the sort of trajectory that some people might take or like some teams were like, you know, in terms of like the standings and like the leagues that they were in and just like how, you know, they could move up and down like the players. And so like, I think that we've already sort of like debunked that as being mostly myth. But in terms of like the play itself, you know, I thought that like, it was all pretty good. I thought that all of the actors were pretty good at, you know, being baseball players. I think that whether they went through training beforehand or even if it was during the movie when either Annie or Crash were teaching Nuke, you know, like those sorts of adjustments were able to be made. And I think that, like, you know, they got all that pretty true. I think that the one part about it that I would probably like, you know, raise is just like the communication like between the dugout. And so like we had a couple of messages from Annie, like, you know, being up in the stands and being like, pass this down to this player. And, you know, the player, you know, get that message and just be like, oh yeah, cool. This is what I need to do. Like, no matter if it actually helped them, which like it did, I just like wouldn't expect like that message to sort of come from, you know, I know she's a groupie, but she's also like just a fan in the stands. And it's like,
seemed a little bit unreal. I will say to, and I'm no baseball expert, okay? I don't know if I'm blowing your mind with that bit of information, Jason, but as far as the game being played, I could be wrong here, but I'm pretty sure Kevin Costner was a pretty handy baseball player. We might have touched on this on Field of Dreams. Maybe it's something that Paul told us. I don't know. It just sprung into my mind then, but I'm pretty sure he was a catcher or something in college ball.
That's information to me. But like, that's some good information.
Look at me contributing to the podcast.
I do remember us like talking about Kevin Costner and his baseball abilities on that Field of Dreams episode. Which, if you haven't listened to that one, that was a good one. So go and listen to that one after you finish this one. But I remember that we were talking about Kevin Costner being a switch hitter as well. And so like he's able to like, you know, bat in the left-hand batter's box, in the right-hand batter's box. And that like obviously contributed to his ability to, you know, swing the bat, you know, pretty solidly as well, like throughout the movie.
Okay. Yeah. Interesting. Yeah. He, I just very unprofessionally did a bit of a Google search here, and he did play baseball in, he was a football, basketball and baseball player in high school, and kept that passion going as he played during his college days too. He was cut from the baseball team by legendary college baseball coach Augie Garrido, but he still supported the team and later said, I just wasn't that good. So there you go. Cal State Fullerton is where he played.
So when Crash tells Nuke to hold the ball like an egg, Crash returns to his position and holds down two fingers to signify that he wants Nuke to throw a curveball. In this particular sequence, there was a runner at second base at the time. The catcher would throw down a series of signs so that the runner at second can't steal the sign and signal the batter on what the next pitch is going to be. So I don't know if that was one of the home runs that were hit against Nuke or not, but you know, if it was, then I think that that would be the reason why there was one.
Yeah, and plus Nuke doesn't throw curveballs, mate. He throws fastballs. He needs to establish his dominance from the start, you see?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Why is he calling for a curveball? I want to bring heat. Shake him off. Throw what you want.
God damn it. Time out. Hey! Why are you shaking me off? Huh?
I want to bring the heater to announce my presence with authority.
To announce your what?
To announce my presence with authority.
To announce your fucking presence with authority? This guy's a first ball fastball hitter. He's looking for heat.
Oh, yeah? So what? He ain't seen my heat.
The other one is that Nuke says the parent major league team is expanding its roster and he has been called up to the show. The Bulls and the Asheville Tourists, who are Crash's new team, continue to play, whereas in reality, roster expansion coincides with the end of the minor league season, and also players for high A teams typically don't go directly to the majors because in that case, they would be skipping two levels.
Yeah, right. Okay. So wait a minute. High A, and then you've got double A, then triple A. Is that right?
Yeah, so the minor league system as it stands at the moment, it starts on rookie ball. There's an international rookie category and then a US-based rookie. Then it goes to single A, high A, double A, and then triple A, and then you go up to the majors. That's the level. In 1987 or 1988, there was just rookie ball, short season A, double A and triple A. And right. So Durham at the time were single A. And so it is true that Nuke did skip two levels to make it to the show.
Incredible. So with the like the baseball format for the leagues and stuff, can the teams move up and down divisions as well?
So they can, I think in like rare circumstances. And so I think that this was another, you know, effect of the popularity of this movie as well. And sort of like the appeal that the Durham Bulls had and, obviously looking to increase their attendance and, upgrade their stand. I do believe that, I think it was like within like 3 or 4 years of this movie being released, they actually got put up a league, and so, or a couple of leagues, because they're in Triple A now.
Yeah, right. So, wow.
Yeah, yeah, it can happen.
Yeah, that's interesting. So it's not based on league position or anything like that. It's more about revenue and things of that nature.
Yeah, yeah. The only like example that I could probably give on someone like jumping two levels to get to the MLB is actually an Australian. So a recent Australian. And so there's a Western Australian catcher by the name of Alex Hall. He went from high A to, which is, you know, three levels below major league, to the major league throughout this current MLB season back in June. And he was only really there for like one game, one night. He didn't play. And so he was the backup catcher. But the only reason, or, you know, I won't say the only reason, because he was quite good for his high A side, the Wisconsin Timber Rattlers. Yes, I know, weird name, but we could get into that weird minor league names so much. But yeah, so he was playing for the Timber Rattlers at the time. He was called up, and the only reason that he was called up was because out of all of the teams' affiliates, so like the Milwaukee Brewers affiliate teams, the Timber Rattlers were the closest to where they were playing at the time. And so he was basically like, you know, there was no one else available on such short notice to come up. And so he was elevated up a couple of levels to be a backup catcher for the squad for the night. Until
right place, right time.
Yeah, until they could get someone else in that was, you know, in AAA or AA.
Yeah, right. Incredible. That's wild that it was an Australian too.
Yeah, absolutely.
Hmm.
All right, we've now got to the part where we look at the actors and their acting performances. And so I'll just run you through the main cast list. And so we had Kevin Costner as Crash Davis, Susan Sarandon as Annie Savoy, Tim Robbins as Nuke LaLoosh, Trey Wilson as Skip Riggins, Robert Wall as Larry Hockett. We had William O'Leary as Jimmy, David Needolf as Bobby, Jenny Robertson as Millie, Danny Gans as Deke. And then we also had Max Patkin appear as himself. And Stewie, you might give a bit more context on Matt Patkin and what he's more known as.
Max Patkin, the clown prince of baseball. He was the guy, if you're unsure after watching the movie who he was, he was the guy spitting the water in the air and doing the odd hand movements, yeah, and things like or... dancing is a strong way to describe it, I'd say. But he's actually he's the real life clown prince of baseball. Is someone that Ron Shelton remembered from his days playing in the minor leagues. And when he was putting this movie together, he said, "Max, I got a role for you, mate." And Max, once he found out that the role was just going to be the role that he plays at baseball games, he was all for it.
Perfect person for it.
Absolutely. Yes.
But in terms of that other cast list, and obviously referencing sort of the Kevin Costners and Susan Sarandons and the Tim Robbins mostly, and anyone else, what did you think of them overall? And is there anyone that you want to particularly highlight in their performance?
Well, I think there's only one person to particularly highlight in this movie, and that's Kevin Costner. He holds this movie together. It's a strong acting performance. I've got to be honest with you, Tim Robbins is a tough hang in this movie. I really, you know, they tried to do this redemption arc with him, and I just wasn't digging it, man. I got to be honest with you. His character was a bit of a jerk, and I kind of wanted him to fail the entire time I was watching. He was just not likable at all. Susan Sarandon was great, but, you know, her character is problematic. So I have mixed feelings about saying that, but, you know, Susan Sarandon is good in almost every movie that she is in. So there's no surprises there. Otherwise, with the supporting cast, none of them really stuck out to me. I don't know about you, Jace, but the supporting cast was a little bit meh, and you could have replaced them with, you know, myriad other veteran actors from that time period. So, it was an okay cast. Tim Robbins' best work was definitely ahead of him. They criminally underused Susan Sarandon, even though she had a major part in the role. I don't think you could even speak to her probably, and she would say that, you know, her character didn't have a lot of depth. And Kevin Costner was just Kevin Costner in the late 80s, man, just killing it.
Yeah, no, I think I agree with you in terms of like Susan Sarandon's character not having a lot of depth. And like, you know, we talked at the start of this as well, where like, you know, we feel like she was just there to be like the femme fatale, the, you know, the person that hangs, like the woman that hangs around a baseball team and sort of just like leeches off, you know, the players in a way, like while still like contributing a bit to the team. And so I think that, yeah, like that was that, that was her character, really. I think that I do agree with you in terms of, like, Kevin Costner just, you know, elevating this movie to, like, the great heights that it is, and that we remember it by. I think that he does bring it all together. He brings, you know, every sort of character, every sort of actor together. You know, whether he is in a scene, or, you know, whether he's sort of not in a scene or not as, like, prevalent in a scene as well. Like, he still has a way of, like, bringing everyone together and, like, making the performance of everyone, like, yeah, involved in a scene, like, you know, that much better. I think, like, yeah, with Tim Robbins playing Nuke, I think that, like, I sort of feel like it's similar, like, for me at least, like, with Susan Sarandon and playing Annie. Like, you know, you want to, in every movie that you know, you watch, you want to, like, sort of, like, relate to the characters a bit, or, like, you know, at least be invested in, like, who they are as characters. And so I think for me, like, a lot of it comes back to the character itself. And so, like, while I may like the, you know, portrayal of these characters by Sarandon or by Tim Robbins, I think the characters that they play make it hard to. And so therefore, like, that's probably, like, you know, my critique in terms of, like, looking at the actors themselves. If that makes any sort of sense.
Yeah, absolutely. It really does. Yeah, I think we could safely say that Susan Sarandon was criminally underused and could have played a much. It feels wrong to say that she could have played a larger role because she was quite prominent in the movie, but I think her talents were vastly underused. Interesting fact about Susan Sarandon: the producers of the movie, which, you know, given the themes of the movie, probably won't surprise you very much. They thought she was too old and wasn't funny enough to until she auditioned and blew them away. So, yeah.
No, that's very interesting. Yeah. I think that, yeah, I have a couple of, you know, facts to round out this, and I know that you do too, Stewie. And so, producer Tom Mount, who is part owner of the real Durham Bulls, he hired a guy named Peter Bock, who is a former semi-pro professional baseball player, as a consultant on the film. And Bock recruited more than a dozen minor league players, ran a tryout camp to recruit an additional 40 to 50 players from lesser ranks, hired several minor league umpires, and conducted two-a-day workouts and practice games with Tim Robbins pitching and Kevin Costner catching. And it was just all to sort of make sure that the actors looked like and acted like real ball players, and that real players acted convincingly in front of the cameras.
Yeah, right. That's interesting. I love in sports movies when they go the extra yard line. That's fantastic. For my part, just to add a little bit of something to this podcast, I've got some what you might call a bit of sliding doors, like what this movie might have looked like if some casting decisions went the other way. Mm-hmm. So the first one I'll talk about is the character of Nuke. I'm not going to say his full name because it's a stupid name. Anthony Michael Hall. Do you know who Anthony Michael Hall is, Jace?
No, I don't seem. I don't think that name jumps out at me.
Okay, so better known as Dexter, I suppose, from the Dexter series. He was considered for the role of Nuke, but was kind of laughed out of the offset almost when he rocked up and admitted that he hadn't even looked at the script yet. So, I don't know if he has any disappointment about that or whatever, but that definitely would be a different movie. I'll probably. You know, I like Anthony Michael Hall. I think he's a great actor. And even though he's a serial killer in Dexter, you're always kind of rooting for him. So that's something. The movie looked very different with him in the role of Nuke. Another person who was considered for the role of Nuke was Charlie Sheen. And things actually got pretty far along with Charlie Sheen playing the role of Nuke.
Yeah.
But he pulled out at the last minute because he'd signed up for another baseball movie called 8 Men Out. And of course he would go on to become Wild Thing in the Major League franchise, which it's criminal we haven't done Major League yet. We've got to get around that, Jason.
We will. Yes.
As far as the Kevin Costner role, this is where you see the difference between a supporting actor and you know, the main actor. Some of the names that are associated with the role of Crash Davis include none other than Kurt Russell, which I don't know if that's a good fit. What do you think? Do you think Kurt Russell would have been a good fit as Crash Davis?
I'm going to say no. But like, I feel like he would have done a good enough job, but definitely not to the heights of Kevin Costner. So
yeah, it's definitely, I know we're obviously biased because we've only seen the version of the movie that exists. So in our mind, Crash Davis and Kevin Costner are synonymous, right?
Yeah.
But even trying to take myself out of that, which is really difficult to do, I still can't really see Kurt Russell doing as good a job in this role. A couple of the other names that were tentatively connected to the role, Mel Gibson was one. I don't think Mel Gibson would have worked. Thoughts?
No, I don't think he would have worked either. I think that you needed someone that can be like a bit more down to earth as Kevin Costner, and I just don't really see like Mel Gibson giving that sort of like allure to being that type of person.
Yeah, absolutely. I agree. And the final name that was heavily considered to play the lead role of Crash Davis instead of Kevin Costner was actually none other than Han Solo, Indiana Jones, Jack Ryan himself, Harrison Ford.
Wow.
I think out of all of the ones I've suggested, Harrison Ford for me, he probably would have fit. Probably a little bit too tall. He doesn't really have a sportsman's body, Harrison Ford. I'm sure that, you know, there's plenty of fans out there that might disagree with that. But, yeah, what do you think about potentially Harrison Ford being Crash Davis instead of Kevin Costner?
I would have definitely bought Harrison Ford being Crash Davis. I think that, like, for me, like, I think that, you know, sometimes I even get, like, Kevin Costner and Harrison Ford, like, sometimes confused.
Okay, yeah.
And so, like, you know, maybe I wouldn't have known the difference, but but I think that Harrison Ford could have done a good job at it. I think, again, like, I just, like, expect Kevin Costner to be, like, that bit more down to earth. You know, whether that is referencing, like, anything else that I've seen Kevin Costner in versus, like, obviously what I've known Harrison Ford as being. But I think that, and I think, like, we're just, like, looking at, like, the role itself of Crash Davis. Again, mm-hmm. like, I think just, like, that down-to-earth part of the role, that character, I don't see Harrison Ford being it.
Yeah, I would have, like, I think Harrison Ford out of all of those from both roles would probably be the best substitute. I probably would have liked Charlie Sheen, actually, as Nuke as well. I think it's pretty safe. It's on the record that I wasn't a huge fan of Tim Robbins in this movie. So, and the final, you know, casting sliding doors that I have for this one is for the role of Annie, Susan Sarandon's role. Melanie Griffith was heavily considered for this one, and they really tried hard to get her onto the set to play the role. But she was busy doing Working Girl and was unavailable to film the movie.
Okay. Yeah, no, that would have been... I feel like I could have bought Melanie Griffiths as being Annie.
Yep, absolutely. Yeah. It speaks to the kind of detriment of the character that really you could have subbed in any actress of note from that time period and they could have probably slipped into that role pretty comfortably.
Yeah, absolutely. All right, well, we've talked a lot about the actors and their characters. Was there any character within Bull Durham that you saw yourself relating to in any way, Stewie?
A little bit. So friends and family, yourself included, Jason, know that I started uni a bit later than anyone else, quite a lot later than anyone else. And, you know, occasionally there's been times in class where I felt a little bit like Crash Davis on the bus when Nuke's playing the guitar.
Yeah.
Just a little bit of that. I definitely felt those vibes. I was like, I feel you, man. I feel you, Kevin. I know what it's like. Crash. I feel you, Crash. I know what it's like.
Yeah.
I guess, how about, like, yourself, Jace?
Yeah, I guess, like, I'm the same in terms of, like, you know, you just got something so good going for you. Like, you know, during the game, you're up 2-0 going into the bottom of the innings, bottom of the last innings of the game sort of thing, that sort of situation. And, you're like, you know, you're taking control and then someone else is just like, nah, I'm going to do my own thing. And, you know, you just get frustrated so many times. I think that, like, I would relate to Crash in terms of, like, getting frustrated that no one would listen to you when it is the best thing.
Uh-huh, absolutely.
All right, we are now approaching the end of the episode, and so we do ask a very important question, Stewie. If you could have a baseball movie get made, what would it be and why?
Okay, so a baseball movie. So I've got this idea, right?
Okay.
It's about this farmer in Iowa, right? Corn farmer, okay? Oh, yeah. And he hears a voice, right?
It says, a voice telling him to do
it. It tells him, you know, if you build it, he will come. And he gets confused about the message. But he builds a baseball diamond. James Earl Jones gets involved. Ray Liotta's there. And then eventually his dad rocks up. And it's a really feel-good kind of movie. This is my original pitch for a baseball film. You know, I don't know what you call it. Maybe you got an idea for a name of that movie, maybe?
No, I was going to say, like, I have a feeling that a movie of, like, that premise... honestly, I feel like that movie could become a massive hit.
It could be. Who knows? Maybe we'll be covering a movie similar to that of Goals on Film.
Maybe. I think anyway.
This is just my lame way of saying I don't have a good idea. Obviously, I've just pitched Field of Dreams to you, which we have done. Finish this episode, go back through the catalog and give it a listen. Great episode. I don't have one, but as a softball and baseball aficionado like yourself, Jason, I'm sure you've got a great one that can save this segment.
Yeah, well, I mean, I'll just bring it back to, we have done a couple of baseball related episodes, such as Moneyball, such as Field of Dreams, such as now Bull Durham. And so I encourage you to all go back and listen. As we said, celebrate the postseason, whether your team's in it or not, by listening to a couple of Goals on Film episodes. And so now comes time for my idea. We've talked a bit about minor league baseball in this episode, and obviously the Durham Bulls are a minor league baseball team. I think I've mentioned a couple of other minor league baseball team names as well.
Mm-hmm.
And my film idea is just where they get these minor league baseball teams' names from. I don't know if I've mentioned any of these couple that I'll like rattle off now in the episode already, but there are a couple of minor league baseball team names that are just so funny. And these are a bit of my favorites. So you've got teams like the Binghamton Rumble Ponies, the Fort Myers Mighty Muscles, the Hartford Yard Goats, the Jacksonville Jumbo Shrimp, the Lansing Lugnuts, the Pensacola Blue Wahoos, the Quad Cities River Bandits, the Rancho Cucamonga Quakes, Rocket City Trash Pandas, Sugarland Space Cowboys, Toledo Mud Hens. It's just like, I'm sure that, like, yeah, you know, you can find so many other, you know, weird names for baseball teams as well. But like these ones in the minor leagues especially, and like there may have been more that I missed, but these were a couple of my favorites. My film idea would be, yeah, just how they come up with these names, because I really want to know.
Yeah, me too. The Lansing Lugnuts. Isn't a lug nut the nut on your wheel that tightens it up, that makes sure it stays on?
Yep.
Oh, what a shit name. My God. That's terrible. There's some hilarious ones in there. I particularly like the Trash Pandas.
Current Aussie Aaron Whitefield plays for the Rocket City Trash Pandas at the moment, so
yeah, right, interesting. That's fascinating. I think that's a great idea. Who knows how they get these names, but geez, I'm glad that they really give them some thought. 10 points for creativity.
All right, that does now bring us to the end of the episode. So Stu, would you like to provide your social media handles and anywhere else our viewers can see or listen to you?
Absolutely, mate. You can get me on Twitter at Stewie is sick of it, and you can get me on Instagram and TikTok at Stewie the Sports Guy. Chuck me a friend request on TikTok. I'll friend you back, and then I'll send you a stupid amount of videos that you probably don't care about. Also, you can hear me just about every week here on Goals on Film. Fantastic podcast. Go back through the catalog. Give it a listen. Even the episodes I'm not on are great. So, you know, there's that. You can also hear me on After Extra Time, the World Football Podcast, week in, week out. Myself and Paul M. Banks will go through the English Premier League and any other goings on in the world of football.
Very nice. And you can catch me on both Twitter, Instagram, and TikTok at Jace Irves. That's the handle for all three of those. And as always, every single episode, every single week of Goals on Film. You have been listening to Goals on Film. You can find Goals on Film on Twitter and Instagram at Goals on Film Pod. Goals on Film is part of the Edge of the Crowd network. You can find Edge of the Crowd on Twitter, Instagram, Facebook, LinkedIn, YouTube, and TikTok at Edge of the Crowd. You can also view any of our stories, be it sport, culture, or politics, on our website, www.edgeofthecrowd.com. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you next week.